See, this can also happen in other areas of the practice. You can have an unusually productive employee who literally does the work of two or three normal employees. When it comes time to add your next staff person or replace this person because she quit, you're shocked by how many people it takes to replace one employee. Some of you may remember a recording we released a few months ago called Staff Equivalence. That term implies that not all staff are equally productive. Some staff are the equivalent of two, and others are the equivalent of, say, a fourth or a half. Some doctors have trouble getting past the fact that they're literally going to have to hire two people to replace the superwoman who just quit. I had a client once whose strategy was to build a large, highly profitable practice by only hiring superhumans. They all had to be exceptionally talented and highly trained. Unfortunately, he could never get his practice past a certain point because he could never keep enough of these people on staff. When he lost one of these exceptional individuals, you know, the ones who could do the work of three, it took him over a year sometimes to find and train and replace this person with an equivalent employee. I can remember when he was down two of these people at one time. His income had dropped by $60,000 a month. The strategy ultimately failed, leaving him with a practice that production fluctuated wildly. You see, it's better to have a practice built on systems rather than superhumans. In our most successful practices, you'll see one or two great staff. We usually call them team leaders. And then you'll also see a goodly number of highly motivated, but more normally talented people. All right, let's go on. I want to look next at employer dependency. This is a problem not limited to small communities. It can happen anytime you wake up and find that 25% of your practice is made up of patients that all work for the same employer. In the town occupied by one of my clients, 40% of the population all worked for the state. He was notified at the last minute that the state was moving their operation to the town where the state capital was. He was devastated because 80% of his practice all worked for this one employer, the state. He was literally faced with a practice restart, and he had not personally done anything to cause the problem. So the question, could he have seen this coming? Well, if he had listened to this tape, he might have. He would have had to either cultivate, and done so consciously, non-state employees as patients, or made plans to sell the practice while it was still viable and leave the area. It isn't just layoffs or plant closures that cause the single employer practice to be vulnerable. It's also changes in their insurance plans as well. See, since the direction of all insurance coverage is downward, if you are a single employer practice, you don't need to wonder what your future holds. Start now to broaden your practice base beyond this single patient employer. Yes, this is a case where you may want to consider a surgical marketing strike, targeting prospective patients outside the confines of this single employer. Now, for most of you, this will help offset your vulnerability. Unfortunately, some of you are in very small communities. You know, you got this one 800-pound gorilla employer who's so predominant that even if you do have a large, purposefully developed patient base outside this one industry, the aftershocks of its economic fortunes affect every resident in the community. In other words, if this big employer has trouble, all the townsfolk, including you, feel the trickle-down misery. If your area is that small and this one employer is that big, you've got to evaluate your risk and ask, what would I do if they were to have, you know, massive layoffs, shut down and leave town, or their insurance completely went belly up? And if you don't like the odds, then you probably better move out while you still can and sell your practice while it's still worth something and get to higher ground. All right, let's go to the next one. Employee fraud vulnerability. I know some of you have seen the statistics about employee theft. It's kind of like hearing about an unspeakable tragedy that's stricken some unknown family on the evening news. You quietly think to yourself how glad you are that it didn't happen to you or your loved ones. I think most doctors feel this way when they hear about employee theft in one of their friends' practices. I hate to be the one to tell you, but this is an all-too-common problem and almost without exception could have been prevented. At least the problem could have been kept to a smaller, more survivable loss if the doctor had followed some basic rules of accounting control. I found that many doctors try to use the trust defense in attempting to prevent employee theft. That is, they place so much trust in an employee that the employee will supposedly feel the weight of their trust shaming them away from betraying their confidence. Unfortunately, even this incredible trust offering is betrayed by employees you'd never suspect. The reason doctors have trouble picturing one of their employees stealing from them is that doctors don't understand how this type of fraud is motivated. They think that an employee who could systematically steal from you must be some sort of closet schizophrenic who's led a double life for years. This isn't always the case. In fact, seldom is it such a person that robs and disappoints you. Let me give you an example of a recent case I came on. An employee had been caught stealing $40,000 from her employer. Now, this is typical and consistent with the cases that I've come across. She had taken the money to finance her daughter's wedding, it came out. When caught, she said that she wasn't stealing because she had every intention to pay the money back over time. She was desperate to put on a decent wedding for her youngest daughter. See, most employees who steal fall on hard times. Others, you know, are little more than victims of circumstances. You know, they find that all the right factors lined up in just the right way, and before they know it, they were taking money from the doctor with every intention of paying it back. Let me give you a look at this profile. It's usually a person who must have access to your funds, and I'll talk to you more about that in just a moment. Second, this person has to have a financial emergency, or worse, she has what I call a specific neurosis. That is to say, when it comes to some aspect of her life, she will do anything to prevent the embarrassment that some event would bring to herself or to a loved one. It could be for an undisclosed medical emergency. So these are a couple of the points of the profile. First, she has to have access. Second, some sort of emergency or specific neurosis. Third, she must have an active enough denial mechanism to convince herself that she will somehow be able to pay the money back without being detected. Let's go back and talk about access for just a moment. You've probably heard it said that you never let the person who opens the mail be the one to make the bank deposit. Now, that's accounting controls 101. But unfortunately, you're going to see it's not enough to always keep you safe. See, this actually happened to me in an office I was visiting during a practice evaluation. There was a temporary employee there filling in for an employee who was out for several weeks. She was trying to be helpful. She took her trash can out and dumped it, and while she was at it, she took another person's trash can with her. Now, normally the trash was emptied by a cleaning crew that came in to the clinic after hours. This temporary discovered that as she was dumping the trash, at the bottom of the trash can of the other employee, that you know, the one she was trying to help out, it was filled with insurance checks still in their envelopes. See, when she dumped the trash, that distinctive look of bank checks could be seen through those glassine envelopes that these checks so often come in. She brought them back into the doctor and cheerfully announced to everyone that most of the insurance checks had been mistakenly put in the trash. As you can imagine, there was an employee looking on who was horrified to find out that her trash can had been emptied while she was in the restroom. Had I not encountered this method of theft in the past, I think it would have slipped right past this doctor. See, you can't accuse someone of theft because they put uncashed checks into a trash can. You can, however, let this event trigger a quiet investigation, which is exactly what this doctor did. The employee who was dumping the checks would open the mail and pretend to be throwing away junk mail. She was, in fact, throwing away thousands of dollars in insurance checks. I know what you must be thinking. There's no way that she can cash insurance checks, so why go through the trouble of putting them in the trash and then digging them back out? Don't ask me where employees learn these things, but trust me when I say that the secrets of employee fraud do get around. This employee was running a classic checkbook fraud scam on our doctor. She had opened a checking account in a name that was almost identical to that of our doctor's clinic. See, this way the bank's computer doesn't pick up the similarity because it's only programmed to find exact matches. Bank personnel know that it's not unusual for checks to be written in the names that approximate but don't quite match that of the real employer. You've seen this before. You've gotten checks from insurance companies written to your clinic that wasn't exactly the way your clinic is spelled and so forth. So the bank personnel are comfortable with that. The employee hands over a deposit slip with an Almost Clinic name on it, along with 5 or 6 large insurance checks. This employee had been careful not to use the same bank as that of her employer. When she was finally caught, the doctor was able to trace over $150,000 in stolen insurance checks to the fraudulent account. One of my early clients invited me into his practice after just having discovered $70,000 had been stolen by a recently departed employee. This doctor actually tracked her down and put her in jail for 70 years. No, he never got the $70,000 back. He did get a judgment and a promise from her to pay it all back. And after another $12,000 in legal fees, he never got a penny of it. To date, the largest case I'm personally acquainted with exceeds $300,000 in provable losses attributable to one employee. While I'm making this recording, I have several clients right now that I suspect are being stolen from. Some of them have all the markings, employees that they blindly trust, unexplainedly thin profit margins. You know, I think that's one of the dead giveaways that you have to certainly follow up on. I've seen doctors collecting $100,000 a month with no explanation other than theft for $15,000 a month in missing profits. Unfortunately, it can be difficult to prove employee fraud. And the last thing in the world you want to do is accuse an employee of stealing. You have to actually catch them or be able to prove the theft beyond any reasonable doubt. Even when you can prove it, you don't go in and confront them. You talk to your lawyer and a police detective. They will guide you in the process of exposing the employee. There is something that you can actually do that's worse than accusing them directly, and that's to talk about your suspicions with another person, employee, patient, friend, etc. If it gets back to the thieving employee that you suspect or have accused them of theft, they can sue you beyond recognition. Isn't it ironic? They've been stealing from you, and then they sue you as kind of a small going-away present, just so you don't forget them. So what are the warning signs? You know some of the classics. The employee that never takes a vacation. When they're keeping 2 sets of books, they're afraid it'll be discovered. This person has complete control of their files from front to back. She opens the mail, makes the deposits, and writes the checks. Your profit margin is mysteriously thin. There's seldom any cash in the till at the end of the day. She drives a car that puts yours to shame. You see her at the local reservation casino playing at the $500 minimum blackjack table. These are just a few of the signs that should put you on notice. If you do see enough of the signs to cause concern, you need to do some homework. Now, don't be seen by your employees as staying at the clinic late at night. Instead, come back down to the practice long after everyone's gone home. Park your car around the back. Do complete audits of about 20 of the charts a night. Do this until you feel certain that there are no irregularities in the file. Tie payments in the charts to bank statements. Look closely at files of patients that you know well. Does the amount of the charges and payments line up with what you know was actually done for that patient? Some of you, may have gone camping as a child and heard grown-ups telling scary stories around a campfire at night. You remember how frightened you were? You're probably feeling that same way right now as you look at your employees through new eyes, like maybe they're aliens from Mars who've taken over the bodies of your former staff. Don't panic. Just take a few precautions. Make sure the person making the bank statement isn't the person entering the deposits into the checkbook. In the practice I work with, where fraud's already occurred, hey, the doctor usually makes the deposit himself or herself. Make sure that the employees take their scheduled vacations. And during that time, do brief chart audits out of the sight of existing employees. And at least once a year, go around to the surrounding banks and check for accounts that could be mistaken for your clinic. Give them the name of your clinic and ask them to pull up clinics whose, name ends the same way and see if anything similar is in there where there could be a mistake. And don't assume that theft is the only way that chart ignorance can hurt you. I have one client right now who'd like to retire, but he fears that chart irregularities that he's recently discovered would be noticed by the new owner of the practice if it were to sell now. He found out too late that employees were charging insurance for improperly coded treatment. Even though it's natural for a doctor to become so involved in the clinic end of things that they mischart errors, it's still not an effective defense if you're ever charged with insurance abuse. Audit your own records on a regular basis. One of my most successful clients stays 45 minutes after staff are gone and audits every chart that's seen that day. He does this because he found that, on an average, there's $900 a day in unbilled services that his staff have failed to charge out. Keep in mind that this doctor is finding $900 a day in unbilled services even with a highly trained group of veteran employees. Think what it could be with untrained employees that are new to the industry. All right, next and finally, underwithheld income taxes. It's easy to imagine a doctor in his or her second year of practice seeing their income double or triple. That's very easy if you're already making nothing in your first year. Then they find themselves underwithheld on income tax. Unfortunately, this can happen really at every stage of practice. All it takes is a major increase in net practice income, and you're going to be paying more taxes at the end of the year. Now, it usually happens when a doctor's income has gone up quickly, only to be matched by an equally fast rise in personal spending. At the end of the year, the doctor doesn't feel anything has really changed. This is when his or her accountant announces that an additional $50,000 of federal income tax is due in 2 weeks. I've seen this set off a very destructive chain of events. The doctor who feels that he now has a tax problem sets out in search of a tax solution. Unfortunately, there's no such thing as a tax solution other than paying the taxes. The doctor that says he has a tax problem really has a money problem. And the brokerage world lies in wait for the person who's come to the conclusion that they have a tax problem. The same person who yesterday admitted that there was no way around paying their taxes today finds that with back taxes looming, they see things differently. Now they think there must be some way of softening this blow. And thus it begins, because now they've mentally left the door open. Never forget that in the end, any attempt to lower your taxes through tax planning will cost you more than it saves you. And pensions are no exception. Those of you who think that you can pour money into pension plans without a repercussion need to think again. There's a value to putting money in a pension plan. Yes, when you put money in pension and you write it off, it's better than putting money in a municipal bond, in one sense. When you put money in pension, it's tax deferred. The value of that deferral is the interest you would earn on the money you would have paid tax on had you just paid it today and bought a bond. Unfortunately, though, that savings has a quantifiable, finite advantage. It's about 10 to 12% of the total contribution. So if a total of $20,000 goes into the pension, if $2,000 of it is spent in costs, employee contributions, whatever, you're upside down, and you're upside down in the long run. You'd have been better off with a municipal bond. I think you're getting the picture here. I think you can see now how subtly this tax problem can creep up on you, even for a veteran doctor. So talk to your accountant. Make sure you're setting enough tax aside. You know, if you get a windfall of some sort, don't just go out and spend it. Talk to your accountant first. It's easy to give money to the government as you're getting it, and hard to give it later after you've considered that money yours, or worse, you've gone out and spent it. We've talked about 9 threats here, and they're serious threats. They can start you all the way back to the beginning of practice if you're not careful. You know, it could be one of them taking root in your practice right now if you're not careful. In fact, you could have one of them going on at all times over your 41-year career and never really get out of the starting blocks. I've seen this happen. So listen to this tape. In fact, it probably do you well to pull it out and listen to it once a year. I think to do otherwise could prove costly. Good luck with this, and thanks for listening.